Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail from north or south, or from the east or west? My heart is filled with love.
Democracies are incapable of waging effective war. Presently, we shall furnish them with further examples. Still, I am free to admit that in North Africa, we built it better than we knew. The unexpected came to the aid of the design and multiply.
That's just an excerpt. It was a much longer speech. He's talking about American aid to the British 8th Army challenging Rommel, and that's where they started the invasion of Europe. They started in North Africa to drive the Germans and Nazis out of North Africa. It would be interesting if Representative Steve Cohen, the demagogue from Memphis, Tennessee, who's been in Congress too long and been in politics too long, ought to pay attention to pronunciation of some of these German words. For a guy who claims in his biography that he's involved with the Memphis Zoo and animal welfare issues, he apparently cannot distinguish between a four-legged rodent and a two-legged propagandist. If you listen very carefully to his FaceTime demography in Congress 10 days ago, approximately. Fortunately, there was hardly anybody in the chamber. When he equated confused Goebbels, which is a rodent, with Joseph Goebbels, who was the German minister of propaganda for Hitler. Can you think of any great oratory that's come out of Congress? In the beginning of this country, we had great orators, people like Jefferson, Adams, even Washington. We had Henry Clay, John Calhoun, Daniel Webster, even Abraham Lincoln, Andrew Johnson. They made memorable speeches. The little giant Douglas from Illinois, who debated Abraham Lincoln. Even though Abraham Lincoln, contrary to Walt Disney's depiction of him, Abraham Lincoln had a high-pitched voice. He wouldn't have survived in politics today. This is the problem. We have demagogues. We don't have orators. We have political hacks. We don't have political statesmen. It's really sad. This is the quality. I guess we get the government we deserve, and this is what we deserve, and this is what we have. And it's time to force these people out of the political sector and let them go into another field, public relations or PR or whatever. Today in history, it's an interesting day on the 28th. Let's get to that. We won't go to the deaths, but let's start with the births. And today, talking about the South, in 1825, George Pickett was born. Now, Pickett, those of you who saw the movie Gettysburg, he was the guy who did this suicidal charge at Gettysburg across that open field and just slaughtered the Union Army under General Meade in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, slaughtered the Confederates. It was, in effect, a bad military decision by Robert E. Lee, whose birthday was also this month, one of the greatest generals, and he was an orator, in a sense, in American history and Confederate history, if you want to look at it that way. And he was trying to raid Gettysburg to get some shoes for the shoeless Confederate Army. And they met the Union Army under General Meade, George Meade, and Pickett did a charge across, I believe, an open field. It was ill-advised, and there's the movie Gettysburg, which depicts this very accurately. And he was born today in 1825. In 1833, a British general who also is believed to have been gay, homosexual, Charles George Gordon, is known as Chinese Gordon. He was famous for his military exploits in China. And then if you see the movie Cartoon with Charlton Heston, it's about General Gordon who fought the Mali, in what is now Somalia. And the movie is called Cartoon. It's a great movie, and it's very accurate. And Laurence Olivier played the Mahdi. For those students of military history who like to see accurate depictions of film of history, I recommend that movie. And then another great Briton who's also he was a correspondent in the American Civil War. He was born in Offran, Henry Stanley. Henry Stanley decided, and there's a famous movie, Stanley and Livingston, starring Spencer Tracy. And Henry Stanley went to Africa to try to locate Mr. Livingston, who had been working in the darkest part of Africa to try to bring civilization and humanity to the natives. And there's this famous line in history, a great oratorical line, when Stanley finally meets Mr. Livingston, finally after cutting through swaths of the jungle, the famous and very succinct statement, Mr. Livingston, I presume. Great film. Look it up. And then we have those of you who use the old adding machine and used Burroughs products. Burroughs, in 1855, invented the adding machine. So this is an American invention. And one of the greatest pianists of all time, he was a Polish Jew, I don't know if he practiced. Anton Arthur Rubinstein was born today, and his son is an actor, John Rubinstein. Another great actor, producer, director out of Europe, Ernest Lubitsch, did some comedy. He was born today. And then this is another British military history disaster. When Khrushchev came with Bulganin, they used to call him B&K, after Khrushchev succeeded Malenkov, who had succeeded Stalin after Stalin died. Here's a little history that the head of the NKVD, which is now the KGB, or Federal Russian Security, they always give it these innocuous names, Beria, Leventi Beria, thought he should succeed Stalin, and he was trying to eliminate his rivals. Well, they didn't want to be eliminated, and so Malenkov, Bulganin, and Khrushchev and the others ganged up against him, and I guess he was eliminated. And so Malenkov became premier, and then he was removed or retired, if I got my history right, and then Bulganin and Khrushchev became co-leaders of Russia. Well, they did a state visit to Britain on a cruiser called the, I guess it's a hard name to pronounce, Ordzikodzinides. And it was the latest Russian example of naval superiority or naval achievement. And the British decided to, MI5 and the British military intelligence decided to send this frogman, famous frogman, Lionel Buster Crabbe. Not the Buster Crabbe, the movie actor. And he was a frogman, and he dove into the waters under the ship and disappeared. And he was down there, in effect, spying on the ship to check out its latest technical achievements and armament and all that. And apparently the Russians had anti-frogmen and surveillance devices. And his headless corpse was found floating several months later. And, of course, nobody ever explained what had happened. The Russians weren't going to tell. It was another case of don't ask because we're not going to tell. And so he was born today. Then we have Jackson Pollock, the great American artist, born today. Another artist, Claes Oldenburg, the pop artist, was born today. And among the deaths, one of the great founders of European civilization, Charlemagne, first of the Holy Roman Empires, emperors, excuse me, and founder of the Holy Roman Empire. He died in 814 today. And then one of the greatest and most notorious of English kings, who reportedly died of syphilis, Henry VIII died in 1547. And also Sir Francis Drake died today. He was a great navigator, and he arrived off the coast of what is now California, and chasing Spanish galleons and acting like a pirate. The Spanish considered him a pirate, so he was his death today. And then we have who's this? William Burke. He's a Scotsman who was a body snatcher, and also he was believed to have murdered bodies, and he was executed on this date. Then we have William Butler Yeats, great English writer. He died in France. And then we have all of the great Schnozz. Jimmy Durante died today. And then after World War II, there was housing that was needed for the young veterans who were coming home, wanted to start families, get married, settle down, start families. So this developer and contractor, William Levitt, he died today. He started Levittown, these suburban track projects. I think it was in Pennsylvania, and he was one of the first people to start this type of development in the United States. And then also in the East, the Yale Daily News started today. And then also in 1858, John Brown started his raid on Harper's Ferry, which he wanted to free the slaves in Virginia. He was caught, tried, and executed. And then we had... in 1916, Woodrow Wilson, that was his first name, Thomas, segregationist from Virginia, became president, I think, of Princeton, or governor of New Jersey, and then president of the United States. He appointed the first Jew to the U.S. Supreme Court, Louis Dembritz Brandeis. And also, this is important to immigration and illegal aliens, Woodrow Wilson also banned, there was a prohibition that an illiterate who was an immigrant could not be allowed into the United States. Well, he eliminated that ban, so we got all these apparently people who were illiterate in the English language or illiterate even in their own language, couldn't read or write. And, of course, we still have some of those people today, even in politics. Yeah. And then this is of interest to people in the media as well. In 1918, Leon Trotsky, his name was actually his different name, Bronstein. He became leader of the Red Army. His grandnephew, Philip Bronstein, was the editor of the San Francisco Hearst American or Examiner. They were called the American Papers when Hearst operated them, William Randolph the First. And so his grandnephew is working as a columnist now for the Hearst San Francisco Chronicle. And then in 1932, Wisconsin became the first state to establish unemployment insurance for their residents. And this is another first important in medical history. In 1935, Iceland became the first country in the world to legalize abortion. I don't know if they really want to, if that's something that's they're bragging about. Of course, Iceland is a mono race country. They're all white people. They're not. You don't see Turks or Afghans or North Africans emigrating there. We do have an air base there, a military air base. I don't know how blacks get along with the Icelandic women or women getting along with Americans. Excuse me. And then 1950, Preston Tucker, the guy who invented the Tuckermobile, which would get 50 miles to the gallon, all the auto companies conspired against him to prevent him from getting the parts to build the Tuckermobile. There's a famous movie about Preston Tucker. They rigged a court case to get him indicted on mail fraud. He beat that case. And then women were barred in 1977 in the Catholic Church. The Vatican decided, they issued an 18-page doctrinal order, I guess you can call it that, which justified the banning for women from the priesthood. And this was the crux of it. They said that Christ and his ministers were, you know, male and male, and women wouldn't fit in there, and also the special relationship of Christ to his mother, the Blessed Virgin Mary. So there was, here's the phrasing, the natural resemblance between Christ and his ministers, I mean male and male. So that's why, up to this date, why women are not allowed, cannot be ordained as Roman Catholic priests. There's a growing cases of malpractice lawsuits and actions against incompetent lawyers, or lawyers believed to be incompetent, or stealing from clients, or in some cases rigging trials, such as the Steve Mary case, and that'll be taken care of in due time. And so we found in our archives an interview that an insurance company that insures lawyers, we're talking about malpractice and how lawyers could avoid getting what they needed to do to avoid getting involved in malpractice lawsuits and being sued by clients. So here we're going to play that interview.
Legal malpractice is understandably not a very popular topic. The scarcity and high cost of legal malpractice insurance for the last few years has created a crisis. But the good news, and there is good news, is that a preventative and self-audit approach can help you avoid most malpractice claims. In the fall of 1985, I requested Lawyers Mutual to start requiring a closed claim report from each of its defense lawyers for every case they handled. The report sets forth pertinent facts of each claim, Also, the defense lawyer's assessment of what our insured attorney might have done to avoid the claim in the first place. As a result, we now have, for the first time, feedback from experienced defense lawyers throughout California on the various causes of legal malpractice. A surprising number of claims have been determined by our defense lawyers to be unjustified. Of the claims we have tracked so far, about 30% appear to be in that category. These claims can usually be disposed of at an early stage without any indemnity payment. Still, our company has to provide defense costs. The information on this tape is designed to help you avoid even those unjustified claims. By using a subjective analysis of each of the closed claims, I've been able to identify the 10 leading causes of legal malpractice. 1. The attorney's failure to calendar a matter properly. 2. The attorney's failure to be clear about his intention to take or withdraw from a case. 3. A client's cross-complaint to the attorney's suit for fees. And 4. The attorney's inadequate knowledge of the law or investigation of the facts of the case. Those first four categories account for more than 80% of all the claims that Lawyers Mutual has categorized as justified. Other malpractice claims can be traced to number 5, poor client relations, 6, the attorney's personal involvement in the case, 7, conflicts of interest, 8, malicious prosecution, 9, the attorney's failure to protect the client adequately in financial matters, and 10, the attorney's failure to document the case. There is no question that far and away the most common cause of legal malpractice is the failure to properly calendar deadlines. This failure usually results in the case of clear, indefensible liability, leaving damages as the primary issue. None of the companies writing legal malpractice insurance look kindly on attorneys who continue to miss deadlines. That is a readily preventable error. To avoid missing deadlines, you must have a dual system of calendaring with your secretary. It's better, and I recommend that there also be a third calendaring backup that produces a tickler reminder of important calendared dates. Remember that it's extremely important to calendar adequate lead times as well as the actual due dates. Calendar every case, not just those in litigation. Do not return any file to a file cabinet without having placed a date on your calendar and having your secretary place one on his or hers for follow-up and review. Even when you are waiting for a response from opposing counsel, there is a time after which you should pull the file and consider additional action. Perhaps the action will merely be a status report to your client. As a further backup, conduct a hands-on review of every file for which you are responsible at least once a month. No matter how good your calendaring system, there always are going to be files that slip through the cracks and don't come up for review when they should. That's the advantage of the hands-on review. Be especially careful with files that have gone out to other attorneys or to other firms. You need a system that allows you to know where your files are at all times. Even though the file may be in someone else's hands, continue to share with that other person the responsibility for making sure that no calendaring dates are missed. Many serious claims are arising from an attorney's improperly rejecting a case initially or withdrawing from a case once it has been accepted. The typical claim that we see involves an attorney who has met with a client, looked over some documents, and done some research. He then turns down the case without documenting his action. Later, after the statute of limitations has run on that case, the client runs into another attorney. That attorney decides with hindsight that the client had a great case which should have been pursued. The original attorney now becomes the target defendant in a legal malpractice case. What can we do to prevent this type of claim? First of all, if you don't wish to accept a case, the only safe practice is to notify the client in writing. It's best to send a letter by certified or registered mail. The letter must contain certain basic elements. First, your firm will not take the case. On this issue, don't beat around the bush. Just spell it out. Second, that there are important time limits that must be complied with to preserve the case. It is just as well not to point out the specific statute unless you are absolutely sure it is the only applicable one. It is better to point out generally that every case has important time limits and that this case can be lost if not promptly pursued. Third, the person should be advised to seek other counsel as quickly as possible to obtain a second opinion. Don't feel that you have to give any specific legal reason for rejecting a new case. Some of our claims stem from the fact that different attorneys find different legal theories as to why the case should have been pursued. For the same reason, don't state specifically why you feel a case lacks merit. Just say that you've decided not to handle it. Some attorneys use the phrase, "It isn't feasible for our firm to handle this case." You have a little different situation if you have already become the attorney of record and you wish to withdraw. In that situation, you owe the client an explanation for your action. Maybe your original estimate of the liability or the value of the case has changed. Again, send your client a letter similar to the one used when rejecting a case in the first place. You must also arrange for a substitution of attorneys or obtain a court order establishing that you are released from the case. Keep your letter courteous and professional, regardless of whether or not there has been a breakdown in the attorney-client relationship. And regardless of what you may now privately think of the client or his case, return the client's documents and offer to cooperate with his new counsel. Generally speaking, it's not a good idea to charge a client for a case that you have decided to reject. It is better just to chalk up the time spent to the cost of doing business. Think of how you would react if, in the absence of a specific fee agreement, an attorney told you that he didn't like your case, but that he was going to bill you $500 for checking it out. Unfortunately, every time an attorney sues a client for fees, he invites a cross-complaint for malpractice. Many of these cross-complaints are not well-founded. At the same time, these cross-complaints have to be defended by your insurance company, and they are malpractice claims on your insurance underwriting record. Therefore, it should be your general rule not to sue clients for fees. Your practice should be conducted in such a way that it never becomes necessary to consider suing. The two most common reasons for unpaid legal bills are, first, the client's financial inability to pay, and second, the client's unhappiness with the result in the case. Suing clients who can't afford to pay often results in an uncollectible judgment or a discharge of the fee in bankruptcy. Suing clients who are unhappy about your fee because they are dissatisfied with the result of the case is likely to produce a cross-complaint for malpractice. I'm not about to tell attorneys that they should never sue a client for fees, but I am saying that it should be done with a great deal of forethought and considering the following checklist. Is the amount involved substantial? Did you obtain a favorable result in the case? Has an experienced, uninvolved attorney reviewed the file and found no potential malpractice? Will any judgment you obtain be collectible? Have you complied with the mandatory arbitration rules in Business and Profession Code Section 6200 and following? Instead of routinely suing clients for fees, it's better to handle your fee arrangements in such a way that lawsuits don't become necessary. Reach a firm agreement about fees at your first conference with the client. Confirm the agreement in writing and give the client a copy. Have the client sign that copy. Since January 1, 1987, attorneys are required to prepare written fee agreements in most cases in which fees are expected to exceed $1,000. That is Business and Profession Code Section 6148. If we're dealing with a contingency fee, then you must comply with Business and Profession Code Section 6147. Always submit itemized monthly bills showing in detail the services rendered for the client. Monthly billing keeps the fees from piling up. If the client should fall behind on any particular monthly payment, you can always deal with the problem at that time. The non-payment of fees may reach a point where you feel it is necessary for you to withdraw from the case. That is much preferable to waiting until you are so far into the case to bill that you have to consider a suit in order to recoup. You must keep a precise time and effort log in your office to support all the fees that you bill. Generally speaking, it's not a good idea to try and change your method of compensation in the middle of a case. That is a good way to incur real client resentment. If, for example, you start out on a time basis, you can really damage your relationship with a client if you attempt to change the fee to a percentage of the judgment or to increase your fee because of an unusually favorable result. If you do wish to change your fee, your client should be advised to have independent counsel review and validate the change. In my experience, attorneys with expertise in one or two areas of law incur fewer claims than those who accept cases in many different fields. If you take on a legal matter outside your normal practice, either become an expert in that area or refer the case to someone who is. Another approach is to associate an experienced attorney when you venture into any new field of practice. Inexperience is no defense to a charge that you acted below the standard of care. No matter what your experience, you will be held to the standard of care of attorneys who practice regularly in a given field of law. So be sure you regularly participate in legal education courses and keep current on appellate decisions in the areas in which you practice. Factual errors are as common and as serious as mistakes regarding the law. Don't rely solely on your client's version of the facts of a case. An independent investigation and verification is essential. In family law, inadequate discovery can lead to overlooked community assets. If those assets are later discovered, the oversight may come back to haunt you in the form of a malpractice action. Many attorneys do legal work that is technically excellent, but are nonetheless sued for legal malpractice. Other attorneys make obvious mistakes but are never sued. The incongruity can generally be explained by the quality of the attorney-client relationship. You can take concrete steps that will improve your attorney-client relations. First, make a clear and fair fee agreement and spell out the scope of your work. Never paint an overly optimistic picture of your client's case. Realistic expectations on the client's part are critical to good client relationships. If you are honest and conservative about a case from the beginning, and if your client sees your work product and participates in the case's development, he is apt to be satisfied with your efforts even though the case is lost. Develop and communicate the attitude that you and your client are a team working toward the same goals. Consult the client frequently and include him in the decision-making process for all important matters. Answer your client's telephone calls the same day or as soon as possible. If you can't get back to the client quickly, have your secretary call him or her and explain why. Don't keep your client waiting for an appointment at your office. And as a rule, don't accept phone calls from other people while you are having an office conference with a client. We recently had a wonderful suggestion from one of our insureds. The idea was simply to give the client a legal file at the beginning of the case. Explain to the client that you're going to send him copies of all the important documents and correspondence. If the client has any questions, he's to call the lawyer and register his input. This is just a good idea. Another way of getting the client involved in the case and let him feel that he's working with you to accomplish the same goal. Lawyers Mutual continues to see claims arising from and aggravated by attorneys' personal involvement with clients in their cases. Don't ask a client to invest in your personal business ventures or those of other clients. Never personally guarantee a client's obligations. And don't lend your personal financial strength to a client's note or to surety bonds required by a client. Never become romantically involved with your client during representation. Do not accept stock from corporate clients in lieu of fees as a general matter. Any of these involvements with your clients is likely to compromise your objectivity. Be careful, too, of slipping into a personal war with the opposing attorney. Such a war often does a disservice to your client. An attorney who has been compromised by a conflict of interest may be required to return all fees and to be responsible for all damages caused by the conflict. It is therefore essential that your firm set up a system that reveals conflicts at the earliest possible time. It is wise to avoid litigation against former clients, even if no true conflict exists within the meaning of the rules of professional conduct. Lawyers are often asked to represent a group of associates putting together a business venture. Another common occurrence is the representation of both a landlord and tenant in drawing up a lease. My advice, however, is not to represent more than one side to any transaction. You will avoid potential conflicts of interest if you make it clear that you are only going to represent one party and that you are only going to bill that party. Advise the other side to seek independent counsel and put that advice in writing. Also, be cautious about representing more than one person seeking to collect from a particular fund. When you're in that situation, have a written agreement outlining the priority for the distribution of any recovered funds. It is not wise to accept the directorship of a corporation if you expect to serve as the attorney for that corporation. Malicious prosecution is an intentional tort, and therefore not traditionally legal malpractice. Even though indemnity is generally not available for intentional torts, still the attorney must call on his malpractice carrier to provide him with a defense. One way to avoid being sued for malicious prosecution is to be careful not to name a defendant in a lawsuit until you have researched the law and investigated the facts that apply to that person's liability. In a doctor's malicious prosecution case against an attorney, the appellate court sent the case back for trial, even though the doctor who had been improperly named in the lawsuit was not served before the suit was dismissed with prejudice. The court said there was a question of fact as to whether the doctor, by just being named in the suit, would suffer an injury to his reputation and an adverse effect on his medical malpractice insurance. A client is likely to sue for malpractice when he loses money in a transaction in which he had a financial interest but wasn't properly protected. Often the security defect becomes apparent for the first time in a bankruptcy proceeding. When a client who reasonably expected his interest to be secured finds himself reduced to the status of an unsecured creditor, he is apt to look to his attorney to recover any loss that results. Sometimes a legal document must be renewed after a certain length of time if it is to remain in force. When you conclude a case involving such a document, always notify your client in writing of the renewal deadline and make it clear that it is his responsibility, not yours, to meet the deadline. The same thing would be true for an option. If you help your client obtain an option, be sure and advise him that the exercising of the option is his responsibility and that he must do it on time. Be sure that money due your client does not pass through a party who offers no financial protection. For example, payments to a seller that are being used to pay off a loan for the benefit of the buyer should be paid through a bank's collection department. If the funds are sent directly to the seller and he fails to make the required payments for the buyer's benefit, the buyer will then seek recompense from the attorney who set up the transaction in that manner. Failure to document matters overlaps many other causes of malpractice. Occasionally, it is identified as the primary cause of a claim. The more complete your paper trail, the less likely you will have to face an unjustified malpractice claim. Put all your important advice to your client in writing. When a client insists on proceeding contrary to your legal advice, make extra sure that you record both your advice and the fact that the client has chosen not to follow it. On matters of lesser importance, it's probably sufficient to dictate a memorandum for your file. We are recently seeing more cases filed by clients against their attorneys for not divulging all the material facts that the clients felt they needed to make an informed decision about settling their cases. Documentation is extremely important if you think a settlement should be accepted but the client doesn't. The problem is compounded if you recommend a settlement that is rejected by your client and then the jury returns a defense verdict. Many of the causes of legal malpractice overlap. For example, the failure to establish an acceptable fee agreement at the outset often results in poor client relations. Poor client relations can lead an attorney to withdraw from a case in an inappropriate time. Inadequate knowledge of the law or facts of a case can result in missing a claim statute or a statute of limitations. Lack of documentation can cause any of the other types of legal malpractice claims. So far in discussing the leading causes of malpractice, I've been talking in terms of frequency. Frequency would be the number of total cases filed in each category. Another important statistic is severity, which is the cost of defense and the cost of indemnity in any particular case. Insofar as severity is concerned, number one on the bad list is an inadequate knowledge of law or facts. That type of claim has resulted in the highest indemnity and defense payouts. Number two is a failure to properly calendar matters. Number three would be the personal involvement of the attorney in the case. Number four being malicious prosecution. And number five being inadequate protection of the client in financial matters. If we had to pick one area of claims that causes the most problems for both frequency and severity, it would be the failure to properly calendar matters, which is number one in frequency and number two in severity. Often the underlying cause of a legal malpractice claim is alcoholism or drug abuse. This is a factor that doesn't show up in the reports by our defense attorneys or in any other available claim statistics. The legal profession and the insurance industry need to give the relationship between malpractice and alcohol and drug abuse a great deal more study and attention. If you know someone that needs help in this area, there is a program available through the State Bar. As we've seen, the primary causes of legal malpractice are ascertainable and correctable.
And that's really important for people, anybody that needs the services of a lawyer. The important thing is you need to know all these parameters so you can avoid conflicts, dissatisfaction, even going to the extreme, we're seeing more and more cases of dissatisfied, angry, unhappy clients who decided they're going to shoot the lawyer, and this has happened. These things can be and should be avoided, and these situations can be avoided by knowing information is power. What you don't know can hurt, harm, and cost you, and also cost the lawyer who screws around. And there are too many incompetent lawyers in my own experience, having worked for a law firm, doing investigations and legal research and filings and service. I've seen gross incompetency and such hysterics. In one case where one of my favorite subpoena service cases, was kind of funny. This defendant, it was a tenant landlord tenant case, was difficult to serve. So what I decided to do was to get some flowers and attach them to the process papers. So I went to dress up and put on a suit, had a haircut, all of that, shaved, and went to the woman's place of employment and contacted her there. And I said, lady, you're served. And she saw the flowers and she was beaming and all of that. And her lawyer calls up my boss and starts screaming, you're harassing a female and all of this. So she was one of these feminist lawyers. And this is another problem. We're seeing a growing number of these people I've seen over the last 30 years. They come into law school and they think that they not only sit on the right hand of God, but they are God. And they think that their bar card confers upon them infallibility, omnipotence, and omniscience. And they know everything, and the client knows nothing, or other people don't know anything, and their bar card makes them superior to every walking other person who's walking this God's good earth here. This is one of the problems. Lawyer arrogance is the best way to describe it. Also, as illustrated in this lecture tape by the insurance company, that lawyers do not do or have their associates or their people like me, legal researchers, do the research for particular cases. And because lawyers really don't have a lot of time to be doing that, and they've got to come up with a pleading, a written pleading, put in the proper form and on the proper, citing the proper civil procedure, and having it filed on time and a number of copies and then served. And what has happened is the best advice and came from a controversial, one of the most controversial lawyers who ever lived in this history, in this city, was Vincent Hallinan, who was a lawyer for the corrupt Longshoremen's Union. In fact, he went to federal prison on some other charge, and he fathered, he was the paterfamilias of a family of lawyers. Most of them are corrupt, Terrence Hallinan, controversial Patrick Hallinan, and then the grandson. But anyway, he's given people one important piece of advice, the law or a case is 90% research and investigation and 10% preparation. That is putting in the form, getting it ready for trial. But you've got to go out there and have the facts investigated and keep up on appellate decisions on particular points of law. Because there's a lot of cases that get overturned or there's new spins on them by the appellate courts, whether it's state appellate court or federal appellate court. And we've seen so many, and lawyers don't do their research. The most notorious lawyer that I know in personal experience was the George Walker case, and we've got certified copies of this guy's incompetence, and also how he screwed these people or ripped off, or depending on how they want to look at it. They sued him and got part of the money back. There was no fee agreement that he got $30,000 up front for a criminal case, which he was supposed to file a motion for change of venue and investigate the case, which he didn't do. He prior got a $5,000 check to investigate the case, which he didn't do. And these people were living down in Southern California in the Steve Neri case, Dr. Dreisbach, and they sued Walker, George Walker. And unfortunately, they sued him in the wrong state local bar. And it's unfortunate, you know, local cooking of a case. And, of course, there are other complaints about this guy. He'd been sued in other cases. And you can go to amicusveritas.org and look up George Walker. He's not related to Judge Walker or any of the other Walkers, but he's a black lawyer connected allegedly to the Black Panthers. And he claimed he had 500 cases, but when I asked him, what were the disposition of those 500 cases? How many of them were wins? How many of them were acquittals? How many of them were appealed? How many of them were convictions? How many of them were executions? How many of them were overturned? I couldn't get any of those statistics. So this is what's important. And it's important for everybody who needs a lawyer, even if it's a friend, that you need to lay these things out in front. Know what the fees are, if it's what the billing is, what you're expected to provide. Make sure that you have duplicate copies of any papers that you give the lawyer, because files do get lost, and it's a problem. And in the courthouse, it's very expensive and very difficult to photocopy documents. So have all that ready before you see a lawyer. And make sure before you go into that lawyer's office that you're coming down there with what he needs or what she needs. You know, this important due diligence on your part as a plaintiff or litigant or a defendant. The other important thing is that don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be bamboozled by, oh, I've worked in this field for blah, blah, blah. If there's some doubt in your mind, you're paying for his or her services, ask. Write down questions even before you go into that office. And the important thing is make sure if you can't make a court date, make sure you inform the lawyer well in time so he can get a continuance, because clients have a responsibility to meet their obligations in the case of which they are being prosecuted or they are prosecuting. on this conflict of interest business, what we used to do, and it's interesting that Justice Scalia, in his excellent book, this he is what I call an incandescent judicial intellect, talks about how law firms investigate the judges and other lawyers in cases that they are involved in. And that's important to know, intelligence. Know who you're up against, who's hearing the case. As Roy Cohn used to say, the gay lawyer who died of AIDS, who was in the McCarthy Army hearings, Senator Joseph McCarthy, that controversy, and in he was a lawyer for the government in a successful prosecution of the Rosenbergs in the communist atom bomb spy theft case. He got a conviction. Everybody in the way they did the case in New York Circuit, Federal Circuit, was everybody was Jewish. The judge, the prosecutor, the defense lawyers, and, of course, the Rosenbergs were Jewish. I don't know if they practiced. But he did say something about how he conducted his law practice, and he was what they call a wunderkind. He got out of law school very early. I think he was 19 or 20. Usually it's late 20s, early 30s, a lot of these students who go to law school or did. And he used to say, don't tell me about the case, tell me who the judge is. And it's very cynical approach to lawsuits and these cases, but there's quite a bit of truth to that, because you look at the background of some of these judges. Some were former prosecutors, some were defense lawyers, some were many of them are political hacks, and it goes on all levels, whether it's local, city, county judge, state judge, appellate judge, Supreme Court judge on some of these states. Incredible bad backgrounds on a lot of these people that we have seen. So you need to know this information. Since we're pushing improvement of public oratory, we'll be including excerpts from speeches given by famous people throughout American and British history. And if I can find something, excuse me, in people, foreigners who spoke English and gave speeches in I think Charles de Gaulle did speak English, and I unfortunately lost that clip. But he was another great orator, and I think I have something of his when he came to America, but we'll try to find that. So we're going to end right now, since this was a long lecture, from the lawyer's law firm that handled malpractice claims, lawyer malpractice. We're going to end with our, let's just do this for President Kennedy's humor. Here's a guy who was one of our last good orators, and people do remember the things that he said. Ich ein Berliner, I am a Berliner, when he went to the Berlin Wall, and a great inaugural speech, even though it was written by Ted Sorensen. Ask not what you can do for your country, but that's not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. I mean, those were words that oratory has rung throughout the generations that have come into being since he was inaugurated in January of 1961. I do remember that. I was just a child, kid. So let's just have a little of his humor. He's a guy that, even though with his faults, women and the nude White House swimming pool parties and all of that, still a remarkable president, and who understood literature and oratory. Unfortunately, this Mr. O does not. And there's a book coming out that exposing that Mr. O has more than feet of clay. Here's Kennedy, though.
The 35th President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, had frequently demonstrated a quick and ready wit. But his audience at the 1962 White House Correspondents' Dinner was unprepared for the high humor he revealed that night. It was shortly after his now famous clash with the steel industry, in which the industry had announced and then rescinded a steel price increase.
I have a few opening announcements. First, the sudden and arbitrary action of the officers of this organization in increasing the price of dinner tickets by two. By $2.50 over last year constitutes a wholly unjustifiable defiance of the public interest. If this increase is not rescinded, but is imitated by the gridiron, radio, TV, and other dinners, it will have a serious impact on the entire economy of this city. In this serious hour in our nation's history, when newsmen are awakened in the middle of the night to be given a front page story, when expense accounts are being scrutinized by the Congress, when correspondents are required to leave their families for long and lonely weekends at Palm Beach, the American people will find it hard to accept this ruthless decision made by a tiny handful of executives. Whose only interest is the pursuit of pleasure. I am hopeful that the Women's Press Club will not join this price rise and will thereby force a rescission. I speak in behalf of all of us in expressing our thanks and very best wishes to Benny Goodman and his group, Miss Gwen Verdon and Bob Force, Miss Sally Ann Howes, Mr. Reed, who has some talent, but Mr. Peter Sellers. I have arranged for them to appear next week on the United States Steel Hour. I didn't do it. Bobby did it, but we're going to... Like members of Congress, I have been, during the last few days over the Easter holiday, back in touch with my constituents and seeing how they felt. And frankly, I've come back to Washington from Palm Beach, and I'm against my entire program. Where'd you? I really feel that the only hope in 64 is to, on the Republican ticket, is to nominate Barry. But to be honest, I thought that before I went to Palm Beach. We are glad to have the Prime Minister tonight. Last night he was the guest of the publishers, and again he is tonight. We want him to know... how welcome he is. Lord Dunsany, a distinguished Irishman, said many years ago, to fight England is to fight fate. And I choose to believe in 1962, to be associated with England in a great cause is to be associated with fate. Prime Minister, we are proud to have you here again. We are...
You know, that was President Kennedy, who incidentally was not an attorney. Bobby Kennedy went to law school at the University of Virginia Law School. In fact, we've only had, Mr. O exception, Nixon. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the last Democrat who was an attorney, or he studied law anyway, so practiced. And then Harry Truman was an administrative judge. President Eisenhower was a general. Then we had Kennedy, who studied politics and government. LBJ may have been studied the law. We had Richard Nixon, who went to Duke University. Gerald Ford went to Yale Law School. And then we haven't had an attorney until Bill Clinton, who has no ethics. And then Mr. O, and people can make their own judgments on that. Of course, they're still waiting to see all this great work you supposedly did as editor of the Harvard Law Review. So we'll end. We'll be back Monday, a half an hour show, and that's our schedule. Mondays, Wednesdays, and then Fridays will be the hour show, and we'll try to have the best of. We'll continue with our looking at important dates and births, deaths, and events in history, and how they relate to what's going on today. This is Peter Paul Brizola, and working with the News Shadow, and go to our YouTube Amicus Veritas video sites. We'll be putting more stuff up. And good night. I got a slight cold. Mm-hmm.